Well, hello everyone. Welcome back to another Microsoft Learn Live session. Microsoft Learn Live is a series of guided courses designed to increase your knowledge of Azure and to do it in a way where hopefully you can take the knowledge you learn and apply it to your own project. So we are your guests for today's session. My name's Kim Philpotts. Over here, I think, is Glenn Stevens. Glenn, why don't you go and introduce yourself and say hi, and I'll bring up some contact details for you.
Awesome. Thanks. Hi, Kim. Hi, everyone. My name is Glenn Stevens. I'm a senior content developer here at Microsoft as part of the Learn Live team. I've been a software developer for a very long time. I think my mantra is I just like to build things. I like to build apps, websites, and some IoT devices, and I do a lot of work with the cloud these days as well. That's me in a nutshell. You can see my details, my Twitter handle and GitHub handle there on the screen. Feel free if you want to reach out as well. My DMs are open on Twitter. Hope to hear from you. Kim, did you want to do the honors and introduce yourself as well?
I always love to introduce myself, Glenn. So my name's Kim Philpotts. I'm a senior content developer as well at Microsoft. I'm based in Melbourne, Australia. I'm a developer. I love coding things also. And of course, I love working in Azure as well. So that's all very, very enjoyable stuff. Now, Glenn, in today's session, this is our second session, what we're going to be talking about is we're going to be talking about databases. So what I want to do first of all, if that's okay, oh, actually, before we do that, we should say hi to everyone who's online and just remind people that this is a live session. So if you do have any questions, throw them into the chat window and we'll answer them. There is a slight delay between you know, what we send and what we get back, but don't worry, we'll answer all of the questions. And we also have a couple of moderators on the line, don't we, Graham?
We do. We have in that call that, and we also have Rob Gibbons from our team. So if they want to, they'll probably say hi in the chat window if they haven't done so already.
Fantastic. All right, so yeah, feel free to ask away. Okay, but let's move on to today's session. It's about databases. So what we want to do first of all is go back to the scenario which we discussed in the previous session and just have a look at how databases fit in. So the idea with The idea with this scenario is that we're working for this fictitious company called Van Arsdale, and this company's in the real estate business. And so, of course, they're running a website where they're selling real estate properties, you know, as you would expect from a real estate company. Now, the starting solution for this is built in .NET Core. It's using a SQL Server database. Pretty common scenario, probably something like you'd get, you know, when you do a file new project, essentially. Now, when we started the series and we're in our last session, Van Arsdale was hosting everything on premises. But what we're doing is we're moving that to the cloud. So where we started off is we basically went and moved the web application into an app service in Azure. And so we did that. It worked very well. And I don't think we had any code changes at all, which was really great. And the next thing that we need to do is we need to start having a look at migrating the database, because whilst we migrated the website, if you're in the last session, you know that we ended up with it saying, okay, I don't have a database yet. So that's the problem that we're going to solve today. So Glenn, talk to me a little bit more about what we're going to do in today's session.
Yeah, so we're going to get our project migration just one little bit closer towards giving it a cloud-based database. And the choice of the database solution is going to dictate really how we're going to migrate the data. And that means there's two cool things we're going to look at. First, we're going to select the appropriate database solution for our Van Arsdale real estate project. And once we've done that, we're going to go through some options to essentially migrate the data from on-premises into the cloud.
Yeah, cool. So just a question for you, Glenn. You mentioned that we're going to try and find like the optimal solution to migrate a SQL database into the cloud. And I suppose one of the questions that people have is, you know, are there best practices, or is, you know, this the best approach for every possible scenario?
Is there best practices? I always love that question. My feeling of best practices, you know, this, Kim, it's like there's no best practice, only good practice in context. So it's going to depend on what the current situation is. And there's really just too many variables to have one solution that's going to fit all cases. So to find a good fit, we need to understand the characteristics of the current database that Van Arsdale have. We also want to investigate what our expectations and project requirements are too. And it also depends on the team and the people involved. So management might be careful about spending money. Admin may not want to give up their servers. And then there's the development story. How familiar are the developers with the technology that they're moving to? So what expertise do they already have? And I can imagine there's probably discussions going on internally within Van Arsdale's management, admin and development about that particular problem.
Yeah, and potentially competing priorities as well. But effectively, what I'm hearing you say, Glenn, is there's no real simple answer to, you know, how do I migrate my data into the cloud? It's basically something you want to assess and, you know, decide on a case-by-case basis, you know, based on those factors you're talking about. But the good news is, by the end of today's session, we're going to know a lot more about selecting the best database solution, or, you know, look at the options that are available to us in Azure, particularly for something like Van Arsdale, which is a pretty common scenario. And so what we're going to be doing is we're going to be creating a relational database on Azure. We're going to be transferring the data from an on-premises SQL Server into the cloud as well. So I suppose before we jump into that, Glenn, we should talk about some things that might help get, you know, that people want to have a little bit of experience with in order to get the most out of today's session. We'll start with some prerequisites, right? So one nice thing is if you're a little bit familiar with SQL Server, that's a definite bonus. Perhaps you've played around with local databases and local SQL Servers as well. And you'll also want to have access to an Azure subscription and know a little bit about navigating around the portal. And I think, you know, what we covered in our first session is probably sufficient for people.
Yeah, that's true. And we'll be using some other tools as well, Kim. Like we'll be using Visual Studio 2019. We used that in the first session too. Again, we'll be using the Azure portal. But we've got a couple of new tools that we'll be introducing today as well, the Data Migration Assistant and also the Azure Data Studio. And Kim, we've also got some code up on GitHub, and there's code and instructions all available at aka.ms.vanarsdalerepo. And if you're planning to follow along with what we're doing here today, you might want to have the starter solution deployed to Azure already. So just to be in a state like we had at the end of the previous live session. But if you just want to watch it today as well and go back to it later, then you have that choice as well. Today's session is being recorded. Now, if you also need some guidance for setting that up, there's a handy little guide over at aka.ms/learn-live-session-2-setup. I think Kim's going to post that link in the chat.
I'm going to post that into the chat, Glenn.
Nice.
And I'm just going to put it down the bottom of the screen as well, so people can see that as well. In fact, maybe what I'll do is I'll go and have a look at that and just show people what we can see there as well.
Cool.
So let me just come over to that link that we have, aka MS Learn Live to set up. So this is basically the module. Now we discussed this in the previous session, Glenn. If people want to use the sandbox, the free sandbox that's available in Learn, they can certainly do that. And we've got some instructions in here how to get things set up ready for today's session if people want to go through that either now or a little bit later on. So once we go to that page, we can go ahead and we can activate the sandbox. So we'll go ahead and do that. Because, you know, one word of caution, I suppose, you know, unlike a lot of resources in Azure, there's no completely free tier of the SQL Server database. So if you're going to do this on your own subscription, just be careful of that, I suppose. You don't want any unpleasant surprises, so make sure that you, you know, remove any resources later on. But if you're using the sandbox, like what I'm demoing on the screen here at the moment, as it activates, it's going to be free. It's going to be cleaned up for you. Do you know, Glenn, I just got a server error. And you know what today is?
It's Friday the 13th for us because we're in the future because we're in Australia. Is that what you're saying, Kim?
It is the future and it is Friday the 13th. So it turns out it hasn't worked. But look, Glenn, I always say be prepared.
Yeah, well, we did mention we were live.
This is the joy of being live. So one of the nice things is I've actually already got this set up in my environment here, but I'm not sure if the sandbox is just a little bit broken at the moment. Let me just try refreshing that and see if it.
Yeah, cool. Well, while you do that as well, we do have a few questions in the chat window, Kim. So Anonymous has a question. Could you also cover multi-region? I'm assuming you mean multi-region databases. I would dearly love to run a session on Cosmos DB. It's a particular favorite of mine. But if we after multi-region support for other databases, I think Rob might be able to get some resources and then send them through on the chat window. That's probably a good idea on that one, I think. It's probably a little bit too involved, especially considering the time constraints we have there today. But also feel free to reach out to me after the class if you'd like.
Yeah, fantastic.
And anonymous, what are the max data size limits to use on migration tools? I think that falls into the it depends process as well. And sometimes if you've got more complex migrations, you actually might want to code them. That's what I tend to do. But there's tooling available for a lot of common scenarios.
Yeah.
I hope that those answer your questions. And hopefully Rob can get some resources for you.
Yeah, and we're gonna talk about a couple of different options for migrating that data later on. A couple of different tools that are available. Beautiful. All right. So despite the fact that my sandbox isn't activating, I do have the deployed website here, as it was at the end of the previous session. So here we can see that it's using a mock data repository, right? And it says, hey, I don't have this connection string. So that's basically saying, hey, you've migrated the database. Sorry, you migrated the website, but you haven't done the database yet. Okay, so let's sort of get back to the slides here, right? And what we want to do by the end of today's session is we want to fix this, right? We want to choose the appropriate database. We want to get this hooked up so that it's actually showing our properties again. Okay, so Glenn, I'm gonna take us back to some slides here. And what I want us to talk about, or you to talk about, you mentioned that there's different team members involved and they all have expectations around migrations. You know, if you ask different people, they have different opinions on it. But I think the first thing that we should talk about is some of the different options that we have available to us in Azure in terms of databases, because there's quite a few options available to us. And look, where we'll start off, I'm going to sort of run through some different ones and you can talk to them as we go through, Glenn. So the first thing is this thing called an Azure SQL single database. What's that all about?
Yeah, well, the single database really means, well, it's the equivalent of an isolated local database. So think of it like a database as a service. We looked at platform as a service before. Database as a service is like that as well. It's just that the database is the platform we're using here. It's a database that's mostly isolated from the server instance and other databases on that server too. So the single database comes with some really nice things like built-in backups, no downtime when you're scaling up or down. But we should also talk about the downsides of it as well. So it doesn't support all the SQL Server features. For example, one of them would be writing stored procedures in a .NET based language like C#. You can't do that. But there's also a document showing the limitations as well. I'm not sure if we've got a link to that we can paste in the chat window.
I do. Let me post that into the chat window. It's basically a link that I put there that will actually go through all of the different features of the different offerings essentially.
Yeah, so in terms of scaling, what we need to keep in mind is that with the Azure SQL single database, it's a manual process. So if I need more throughput, then I'll just flick a switch and then it will scale.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. Now you were talking about servers a moment ago, Glenn. Is there a server involved in terms of, you know, is this database running on a SQL server that I have to maintain?
Yeah, well, that server on Azure is a resource that allows you to group databases. One server can have multiple databases, like in a local SQL Server installation, but it's a platform as a service offering. So we don't have to worry about installing patches or doing any maintenance work, really, which is really nice. It's what gets exposed by the cloud so we can connect to it. I guess if we think about the previous session we had, where we had the app service was running on infrastructure that was hosting multiple websites. We weren't thinking about the other servers or components that we're running now, just like with the database in the single database situation. We don't have to worry about the server there, that's managed for us.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so the next offering that we have is something called Elastic Pool. What's Elastic Pool?
So Elastic Pool is similar to the single database, but allows us to share resources across databases. So it's really useful if you've got multiple databases that are not self-contained and you can't predict the amount of resources that each one needs. Or maybe the required resources fluctuate a fair bit. I was telling you about an example I used before, Kim, where I've got a database that I have a lot of geolocation information within, and I share that within other databases in my solution. And I can use multiple databases in that particular situation. It works quite well.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. What have we got next? We've got something called the Azure SQL Managed Instance.
Yeah, so this is the most compatible option when you're comparing to a local SQL Server installation. It's actually a pretty good fit for more complex SQL Server migrations. But yeah, that's probably the closest to what you'd have in your on-premises environment.
Yeah, cool. Now, so these are essentially our PaaS offerings or platform as a service offerings, essentially. Now, look, in terms of database options, you could go perhaps a little bit old school, right? And you could actually spin up a virtual machine with SQL Server installed, right? So I suppose, you know, we're talking about Van Arsdale migrating. So would this be, you know, like the optimal sort of solution for them? Because it actually maps to exactly what they'd have on premises.
Yeah, but if you do that, Kim, have you really reduced the amount of maintenance you need to do on that server? So you'd be responsible for all the operating system updates, all the SQL Server patches, and making sure that the health of that virtual machine is kept up to date. That could be problematic and cost time and, as a result, money.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the requirements that Van Arsdale did have was they want to stop managing so many servers. So yeah, good point. Okay, so all of these things that we've talked about here are you know, just Microsoft products, but there's third-party providers as well.
Yeah, that's true. So things like MySQL, MariaDB, Postgres, a lot of the common databases are there. So even if you went into the Azure portal and you went create a new resource, selected the database options, you'd see most of the common ones that you're already familiar and comfortable with.
Yeah, cool. So I've looked at that list. It's extensive. Absolutely. And there's another one which is very popular. In fact, Glenn, I think you love it as well, which is sort of your NoSQL or NoSQL, one of your favorites.
Yeah, it is my favorite, really. In general, NoSQL is pretty popular. For greenfield projects, it's actually the number one choice today. So NoSQL databases like Microsoft's Cosmos DB store data very differently from the traditional relational database. And they give you amazing things in terms of scalability and also developer productivity, too. It's really great.
Yeah, fantastic. Alrighty. So, you know, we've basically got a lot of different options available to us. So what we want to sort of break down now is what's the best option for our project. Now we've got a few questions before we delve into that. Okay. I'm not sure if we should just take a pause here before we you know, refine our list here. And let's just have a look at a question, shall we? So let me just put a question down here. So the question is there a way you can stop and start this service as needed, not have it running all the time?
If we're talking about a database, then yeah, you could stop and start a service as needed. You can control that aspect, I guess. Like if you only work during office hours, you'd have to maybe script something or control that aspect. The Azure SQL Server also has a serverless option. So if you're not using it in peak time, that's probably a more cost-effective approach. I'd be looking at that aspect. And Tanzan has a question, can we have multiple schemas in the single database? I'm assuming you meant schemas, but yeah, yes, is the answer from what I understand.
Beautiful. All right, so hopefully that's answered people's questions. I'm just having a quick look. Just having a look at this. How about a serverless database? So I think you've answered that one, Glenn.
Yeah, we'll have a look at that a little bit later when we actually create a database instance. We'll look at the configuration settings around that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one more from Anonymous, which is the difference between Azure SQL Database and Azure SQL Server. So we'll sort of go down into some of these a little bit later on, and we'll talk about when we create these resources, when we create a server, when we create a database as well. Cool. So stay tuned for that one. Beautiful.
Excellent. And Rob's answered the question there, what's the maximum size for an Azure SQL database? 35 terabytes, just a little bit of data, that's good.
That's a lot of terabytes. All right, so Glenn, we've got our database options over here. How are we gonna decide the best option for our project?
Yeah, I think you probably wanna look at the core requirements that Van Arsdale have. So it'd be really great to move into a cloud-based database and keep the website code essentially unchanged. If you're thinking about it, it's kind of one of the requirements that Van Arsdale have. They don't really want to change technologies too much, and they don't want to spend time learning new technology as well. But they also don't want to be stuck in an underpowered database server, and they don't want to have an overpriced or overpowered one either. So they're looking for a solution that allows them to scale up or down as needed.
Yeah, beautiful. So it's scalability. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and the other issue they have is maintenance. And that's something administrators will worry about. They want to keep the maintenance as low as possible. And probably the last consideration is cost. I think in our first session, there were a lot of questions about cost, and I think it's still going to hold true. They want to keep costs down, but of course, without sacrificing an optimal customer experience. They're probably the four requirements.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, so let's jump back over to a slide here where we're showing the available options, right? And you just remember we've got, you know, sort of four main requirements from a Van Arsdale solution: no code changes and low learning curve, scalability, low maintenance, low cost. So what we want to do is we want to eliminate some of these to start off with, I suppose. So we'll discuss that. But as we do that, I see that there's a couple of questions in the chat window. One is, you know, wouldn't Cosmos DB be a good option for big enterprises? So I think we'll talk about that in a moment.
I just want to say yes to that. It's really a great database. But like, yeah, there's it's a good option. You've got to see that it fits with your requirements as well. It always depends, but it's a really good one to consider. Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's also from Sandeep, what's the best criteria to select NoSQL versus SQL Server? And again, we'll talk about that in a moment when we're eliminating some of these, essentially.
Yeah, I like the fact that they're asking the questions that that we're actually going to cover, which shows that these are important ones and that you're paying the right level of attention to. Good.
Yeah. Well, these are the important questions that people have when migrating. Absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about eliminating one, and you kind of eliminated one a little bit earlier on, and that is the virtual machine with SQL Server, right? And so I think we can get rid of that one because, you know, it seems like the perfect solution, but you know, we could just take our local SQL Server installation, do a lift and shift into the cloud, but you know, that we're still going to have maintenance, we're still going to have patching, and also you've actually got this machine that's running the whole time, right? So the cost isn't necessarily going to improve for us. You know, so it comes with all the same responsibilities as a local server installation. So I think we can eliminate that as one of our potential options inside of them. Now, the next option we're going to talk about is third-party SQL databases, and we're not considering those, or you know, should we consider those, Glenn?
Yeah, I think third-party systems, for the most part, require us to change our code base, and that's kind of in alignment with Van Arsdale's requirements of they don't want to have code changes. But I guess for other people, like if you've got a project where changing databases might actually make your systems more effective, that might be something to look at. For our requirements right here, right now, the third party is not a good choice. You could possibly do it because our code is based on the Entity Framework as an abstraction layer. But if there's an implementation for the third party system, everything might still work okay. But we'd have to learn about the new technology, and that would also make you want to make sure that you're testing against that new technology as well. So it increases not only your migration, but also the additional testing on top of that too. Because there might be minor issues just preventing us from getting our migration happening. And that's probably enough of a reason to not consider third-party options right now.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, right? When you're doing a migration, you've got enough to worry about without, you know, swapping your technologies in at the same time. Yeah. Okay, so let's get rid of that one. And that brings us to, I'm going to joke and say it's your favorite, Glenn, which is our NoSQL options. You mentioned this is really, really popular. And, you know, there's a lot of blog posts, a lot of information about things like Cosmos DB. So that's a very common form in Azure. So, Glenn, are we going to consider a sort of a NoSQL option?
Well, our project really has a list of houses and allows us to click on each of them and then just have an individual view of a record. So a relational database with highly structured data and a set schema is actually a really good choice for a project like that. So as a developer, we'd probably be able to go and find a primary key, fetch the record for the house, for example, and then show that more, and also do things like have good searching criteria. So Cosmos DB has that same functionality. A NoSQL database databases really store data very differently from the traditional relational databases. So to take advantage of NoSQL features like flexible data structures and variable properties would mean that we need to reorganize our storage approach, and as a result, more code changes, which Van Arsdale doesn't want. So you could do it with Cosmos DB. And in fact, personally, for a real estate project, the two databases I tend to consider are SQL Server and Cosmos DB, also because they have geospatial querying, which I really like. So you can look at points of difference. There's lots of compelling things for it. But I think for Cosmos, there's too many code changes, and that goes against the requirements that Van Arsdale have right now.
Yeah, and there's structural changes as well. That's very important. So perhaps, you know, for greenfields, like you say, probably definitely a compelling option to have a look at. And Glenn, you mentioned the other day that there's now a free tier. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe there's a free tier on Cosmos DB. I'll ask Rob to look up the details and post that in, just to clarify. I don't want to get that wrong as well.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. All right, so we're going to eliminate a NoSQL or a Cosmos for this migration, right? But what we're left with essentially is three Azure SQL type of options inside of there. So how are we going to decide between these, or how can we clarify the differences between these different versions of SQL?
Yeah, well, we started with the requirements to eliminate half the options anyway. So we could also think of the requirements like a wish list. So the four points are no code changes and low learning curve, scalability, low maintenance, and low cost for the four. And they represent what Van Arsdale want to get from a cloud-based database solution. So if we look at what they're currently using, we can define some characteristics that can help us identify the best of those three remaining options.
Yeah, and I think that's it. You know, that's what you need to do. You need to have a look at, you know, what your actual data is. You know, you can't just do it from a, hey, I'm going to move to this technology. You know, is that technology appropriate? So let's have a look at the Van Arsdale database and some of the characteristics of them. And the first thing is, it's actually a reasonably simple setup. It's really just got one database. You know, it's not joining across multiple databases. So there's a single database instance.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, like, we're really fine with the solution. The Van Arsdale project really has one website, one database. And a system that supports multiple interconnected databases wouldn't hurt. But Van Arsdale just doesn't need that level of complexity. They're looking for the best option for their needs right now.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. And in terms of their data itself, they've got a relatively small set of relational data. You know, they list houses in there, and there's not, you know, bazillions of houses. You know, so it's a relatively small set. And if we have a look at the content of the database, it's not particularly complex in types of tables as well, and it doesn't have any complex dependencies between the tables or between databases.
No, that's true. And again, I think they're really trying to find a solution that fits their requirements. So you can make an argument to take the most sophisticated system, but that would just likely introduce more maintenance and more costs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And speaking of costs, right, you know, if we have a look at Van Arsdale's current infrastructure, right, they're hosting the database on premises. They've got it on a dedicated server. And, you know, they basically aren't sure about how much performance they're going to need in the future, right? And so, you know, it's very tempting for them to overinvest in their servers they have on premises. And, you know, if we add in things like, you know, SQL Server licensing costs, you know, the cost is actually a very, very important factor for them as well. And you know, it's a recurring theme that we're seeing questions about, you know, what about cost?
Yeah, and kind of goes hand in hand with their requirements as well. So they want lower costs because they currently have high costs. It definitely is an important aspect to take into account. I think right now, because they're on premises, they have to maintain the equipment, all the networking, all the installation and management of it as well. So it's a change in costs for capital expenditure and ongoing expenditure.
Yeah, and I suppose one other aspect is where the data's stored, like in a geographical context as well.
Yeah, and look, the database server they have is in a very specific data center in their own server room. So there's no secondary server in a geolocation, so they don't have the backup levels that they probably need. So for now, Van Arsdale don't really see the need to replicate data locally because they're a real estate company. They're probably based very locally as well. So a single instance is probably going to be able to cope with the expected traffic of their website. So SQL Server can handle a lot of requests.
Yeah, SQL Server is amazing. All right. So that kind of brings us back to the options, right, or the potential candidates that we had. And I think we can eliminate one more just based on the requirements we talked about, and that is the Azure SQL Elastic Pool, right? So it's kind of meant to, you know, share resources across multiple databases, support things like cross-database queries. And, you know, looking at our database, we know that Van Arsdale doesn't need that extra sort of feature, that requirement. They've just got one database. They don't have complex queries or even cross-database queries in their case, right? And so for them, it means we can basically go and eliminate our Elastic Pool. And so that leaves us with two options here, Glenn, the Azure SQL single database and the managed instances, right? And I think that can be a challenge, people working out which is the right one, because they're both, you know, potential candidates, and they actually supply everything that Van Arsdale needs. You know, particularly interesting, I suppose, as well, is they're actually both available at a pretty similar price point, right, when you're using a similar configuration as well. So what we need to do, Glenn, is we need to work out or talk about which of these might be a good option for different environments. So maybe what I'll do is we'll zoom in. We'll do a little bit of a comparison between these.
We'll zoom in. All right, I'll move closer to the camera, Kim. That's fine. Now, look, we started by looking at the project requirements. We eliminated like more than half the options, like two-thirds really already. We also inspected the current database characteristics too. So there's only one single database instance. We've got a small set of relational data. There's high cost of running on our own servers, and the database servers only used in one geolocation. So that eliminates the Elastic Pool option. But Kim, as you said, the cost for both instances are actually really similar. But there's actually one thing related to cost that's only offered by the single Azure database option, and that's an extra low cost tier that's particularly useful while you're doing development, and allows us to configure the database so we pay only roughly $5 per month. And that's a clear bonus of the first option.
Yeah, so low cost deployment, which is a little bit different to our managed instance, absolutely.
Yeah. So if we read the documentation of Azure databases and the managed instance, we find that there's a recommendation, which is Azure databases are recommended for smaller projects and managed instance for large migration projects with multiple databases.
Okay, so so like you say, Azure SQL database instance, recommendation for small projects, you know, managed instance for large ones. Okay, cool. So
yeah,
here, Glenn, what's our last?
Well, I think there's you really just don't need a more complex solution when a simple one will do. And it becomes obvious when you look at that last selection criteria. There's a fast setup and there's easy configuration. And just remember how low maintenance or low learning curve are important for Van Arsdale. So we want to keep that in mind, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if we go into the Azure portal, we create a SQL managed instance. What we'll find is that actually the deployment can take quite a while. I think sometimes it says it takes up to 5 hours, and we can compare that with the Azure Single DB, where you can actually just set it up in a couple of minutes as well. And I think that means that we have a pretty good option there in terms of Azure SQL Single Database is very fast and simple to configure. And I think that's the option that we'll use, right? So it kind of meets Van Arsdale's project requirements best. Pretty good replacement for their current database system, all things considered. And you know, it gives very predictable performance at different service levels as well. And it basically has zero administration as well. And one of the other cool things as well is we're going to be able to connect to it just like we do with our existing SQL Server database. And we're going to be able to use exactly the same tools to talk to it as well.
Yeah, it's a good choice. So we'll connect to the database from our local development environment. We're going to keep using the local database, or we can change the connection string in our web app to point to a different database instance that's running in Azure. So it's not really that different from connecting to a local database hosted on a local SQL Server installation. Remember, they just wanted to not have to train their developers in new technology where they could avoid it. And this is going to give us a good option.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's pretty good news, right? And that's important to understand as well. There's really no difference whether you're connecting to a local server, which has got, you know, a host name or a URL or an IP address that, you know, you're getting from an Azure SQL database. So I think what we want to do, Glenn, is we want to go ahead and we want to create a database. Let's just get in and let's do some stuff. All right. Cool. So I'm going to switch across to our desktop mode here and go into the portal. And we're going to want to create a database here. All right. Now, as we go through this, Glenn, keep an eye on what I'm doing because it is Friday 13th. You know, we don't want to upset the demo gods. So where are we going to start off? We're going to go ahead and we're going to create a resource. So I can do that up in the top here, or I can come up here and I can create a resource. Now, just to put things in context here, this is, I am under my subscription here. I'm not under the sandbox because, as you saw, that had some troubles earlier on, but let's create a resource. Okay. And down the left-hand side here, we've got all of our different options. We've got databases. Okay, so if I click on databases, there's a bunch of different options here, and there's even more. So if I click, see all, there's lots of databases in here. And there's, you know, all these see more links here as well. So there's a bunch of different databases available to us.
Yeah, any commercial database you'll probably find there.
Yeah, and look, there's databases there I've never ever heard of, which is probably good. All right, so what we want to do is we want to create a SQL database. So I'm going to go ahead, select SQL database. Beautiful. I'm going to select my subscription. So I'm in my Visual Studio Enterprise. Now I created, I was anticipating Friday the 13th. I actually created a pre-baked resource group, which is where I have the solution put out to. So I think we'll put it in a new resource group just so we can see that in there. What do you think? Oh, actually, I'll put in the pre-baked one. We'll just create a new one inside of there. That sound all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Beautiful. All right, the next thing I need to do is I need to pick a database name. All right, so we discussed some naming guidelines in the last session, and I'm just going to pop a link into the chat window, which is a really good reference for coming up with naming guidelines. But look, this is where I'm specifying my database, right? So I'm going to use a prefix SQLDB, and we'll call it Van Arsdale-dev. Okay, so that's my dev database. Now, the next thing we're going to have to do here is we're going to have a server inside of here, right? And when you create your first Azure SQL database, you're also actually creating an Azure SQL logical server. And I think a good way of thinking about this is a logical server is like an administrative container for your databases. So with that, you can control logins and firewall rules and security policies all through that logical server. And of course you can go and override those policies for each database within a logical server. And you know, we can add more databases into it later on if we like. I already created one earlier on, but let's create a new one here. So I'm gonna say create new, and then I've gotta come up with a server name inside of here. And this server name has to be globally unique, right? So let's use something like SQL. Maybe I should zoom in here. I'm not sure whether people can see this okay. Let's have a look. Okay, so I'll create something like SQLDB. And you can see I've created one of these before. Let's go SQLDB Van Arsdale, and I'll make that dev. Okay, next thing is I need an admin login. Interestingly enough, you type in admin and it says, hey, you can't use admin. So that's a nice little bit of protection. So I'm gonna do what most people would do and just go Van Arsdale admin and put that there, and a password. Okay, and there's some definite requirements for password lengths in there as well. All right.
You've got the location there as well, Kim. So just like we were saying in the previous session that you should have your web app in a location closest to your customers, you should also have your database as close as possible to your web app if your web app's communicating with it. Down the latency.
That's a good point. Yeah, it's our web app that's going to be talking to it. So reducing the latency between those two is a definite plus. I think we are probably in central US. Okay, so we're not in Australia because we put our web app next to our customers. So we're going to say central US and we're going to go okay. Beautiful. Okay, do we want Elastic Pool? No, we don't want Elastic Pool. We don't need those. And the next thing that we have here, Glenn, we've got all the sort of credentials we need. We've got this other configuration option here, compute and storage. What's compute and storage all about?
Yeah, well, we probably have to park the Azure portal screen for a bit and actually discuss some of the parts about this. So we might switch back over to our slides for a second, Kim. Yeah, sure. And there's actually three separate things used to define the performance of our database. So there's the CPU, there's the memory, there's things like disk space or the bandwidth, and also the throughput. So a certain combination is going to result in a certain price tag. So even if I make some numbers up, we might pick a configuration with 4 CPUs, 32 gig RAM, 10 gig of storage, and the Azure portal will give us an estimation about the monthly cost. And I'm not sure why we're using such a retro floppy disk image in the slide there, Kim.
It's the universal for storage. Actually, here's an interesting question. Let's see if anyone gets this right. Because I looked this up yesterday, how many floppy disks Windows 95 came on. Let's see if people get that. We'll come back to that question later on. So throw your answer in the chat window. All right. So Glenn, we've got what you're saying here is as we up our CPU and RAM, it's going to have an additional cost, right? That seems fair enough. But does it mean I have to spend a whole bunch of time analyzing this all up front? Because if I pick too high a tier, am I going to be wasting money? What can we do in terms of sizing this?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Keep in mind, remember, it's essentially platform as a service, in this case, database as a service. So you can always change the configuration. You can scale up, you can pay more, but you can also scale down and pay less if you notice that you've allocated too many resources. So it's actually very similar to actual hardware, but it'd be almost impossible to dynamically remove CPUs or RAM from an existing machine. And also the hardware has also been paid for already. Interestingly enough, there's a question on the chat that I think is kind of relevant to this space as well. Does cloud provision databases allow configuration changes that are version controlled to use IaC as infrastructure as code for configs? Yeah, I'm not too sure on that, but I admit, but you could always change your configuration and then export an ARM template and version control that at the very least. But yeah, maybe Rob can or Matt can find something out about that and get back to you in the chat window. But yeah, that's a great question.
It is a great question. I think, and I suppose there'd also be things to consider like migration paths if you're using like Entity Framework.
Yeah.
All right. So
there's also answers to your floppy disk question there, Kim.
I can't give that away quite yet. So there's some good ones. 40. We range everywhere between 3 and 40. Excellent. All right, look, but I think we've got all of the information, Glenn, or at least we understand, what we're doing with compute and storage inside of there, right? So let's have a look at this configured database inside of here, and let's have a look at what's available to us. So if I click inside of there, and I might just sort of zoom back in again so people can see this, there's a number of different options. We're going to work through some of these, but you can see at the moment, I'll ignore this right at the moment. We'll talk about that in a second. We've got our compute hardware. You can see that I'm using Gen 5 here. We'll talk about that in a sec as well. But we have this concept of V cores, right? And I can specify how many V cores. And you can see as I change that, we can see that it's adjusting the dollar figure that we have there. So a vCore is actually an abstraction, right? So like a rule of thumb, I suppose, is you can roughly map one vCore to one physical sort of CPU core, if you like. So if you, if on your on-premises, you've got 6 CPU cores, you'd probably, choose 6 vCores. Now, interestingly as well, you don't specify memory inside of here, because every vCore comes with a pre-configured amount of memory. And that's why we don't have a slider for that, but we can set the amount of disk space that we have there. So, you know, when we're creating a database, our main focus is on, you know, how many vCores do I need and how much disk space should I allocate?
Yeah. And I think the concept of vCores actually makes it really easy to configure exactly what you need. And we've already said this, but you can always change these settings as you go without downtime. But there's also more settings on this page too, Kim. So it reads Gen 5, and I can select the change configuration as well, that if you click that link there too. So in that screen, if that when it comes up, we can define the hardware generation that we run on. And you can actually pick an older generation. We might be able to potentially save some money in that process too, but the configuration might still be fast enough for most people's needs.
Yeah, absolutely. So I can select that. And actually one of the big differences I see is you can actually drop the vCore down to one. You can save some money for sure.
That's cool. So there's also other options as well, things like hyperscale or business critical. So if you need super low latency, you might want to check those out. I don't think we really need extreme low latency for our particular project.
Yeah, no, I think Van Arsdale doesn't have those requirements at the moment. Right? So I suppose, you know, this vCore based approach that we can see down here, this is like the recommended way of configuring a database these days, right? And as you said, there's, you know, for certain situations, you might be looking at business critical. You know, you might have a look at the generation of hardware that you're using. But, you know, at the end of the day, the concepts pretty much stay the same, right? But there's also another option here, which we haven't had a look at, so we haven't talked about, and this is provision versus serverless. And if you think back to our first episode, we were talking about you know, app services and different ways of hosting in Azure. And, you know, we talked a little bit about serverless and, you know, we talked about functions and functions as a service. And the idea there, I suppose, is when you're using those, you only pay for your actual execution time, right? And that's pretty much what, you know, serverless is talking about. It's like pay as you go for only as long as you're actually using the resource, right? As opposed to provisioned, which means essentially you know upfront how much you're going to pay per month, you know, but you have to pay that even if you're actually not using the resources as well. So, you know, interestingly, you know, if we have a look at the costs over here, if I select serverless, we now got a different pricing model. It's all about, you know, the amount of compute you're using. But one of the cool things about this is we can actually sort of tell it the max and the minimum vCores that we might want it to scale out to, right? So that's one of the nice things about serverless is you can sort of say, hey, well, you know, scale out to 6 and always keep a minimum of 1, for example. So we do have that, you know, gives us a little bit more flexibility essentially inside of there. So now that we sort of know, you know, we've got this option of going either provisioned or going serverless, you know, we need to think about which is the correct option for us. And I think, you know, what our requirement is at the moment, we have this on-premises SQL Server installation. We know it's hardware configuration, right? Because we have it on-premises. And we want to achieve the same performance as that local SQL Server installation. But we want to be able to scale further and we have to consider cost. So what do you think, Glenn? What would be a good choice for our scenario?
So if you have a website up and running with a database, you actually probably already know what to expect traffic-wise. You would have had some metrics done on your actual on-premises installation. So in that case, provisions seem to be the best option. So serverless would be cheaper if there's no traffic or if there's spotty traffic as well. There's a question about what do you earlier in the session about what happens if you only want to run your database for a certain amount of time. Serverless is actually a really good option for a situation like that where you may only run it for an hour or so. I remember years ago I had a client that only wanted a database operation once a week for about half an hour. For him, serverless would have been amazing, but he had to provision an entire server. This was long before cloud databases were available to us. But yeah, going with provision, I think for Van Arsdale is what we really need to do. And with the provision selection, you've got the number of physical CPU cores translates to the number of vCores. The amount of data is known because we've already got an on-premises installation. You get a predictable monthly cost known up front. And you can just start with one vCore during development and then scale up. And you can scale at any time.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So that's probably a good option for us. It's a nice, safe option that we understand essentially. But look, it's still costing me $140 a month, Glenn. Is there a way we can reduce that further? Particularly for today's exercise, right? We kind of want to just have a lower cost option. Is there something that can do that for us?
Yeah, there is. And Kim, if you just move to the smaller option, I'm not sure if I might need to resize my screen to get to this as well. But where it's got the looking for basic, standard, and premium in the top left,
yep.
Let's click on that. Yeah, so that's a different model. And it's using something called a DTU. So let's start out by describing the DTU and explain what it is. The DTU really stands for Database Transaction Unit, and it was a different model. It was a model before the vCores. So DTU is a measure. So it's really a blend of CPU, memory, and input output. So the idea is to create a measure that would give us a relative idea of the amount of power or resources behind the database. So the higher the number of DTUs, the more powerful database we had. But the problem was for many people just not knowing exactly what a DTU is. And that's kind of why vCores were introduced, because it's simpler to translate your on-premises hardware resource specs into similar specs on the Azure SQL database platform. So you might ask yourself, which one should I use as well? And again, like most things, we tend to say it depends. So the DTU model is simpler as far as the number of options that you have and the number of levers to pull. There's one fixed price that includes everything. And the vCore model gives you more flexibility and more transparency into what you're actually paying for, though. But there's a really, really nice benefit to the DTUs, is that you can get a really cheap database option for very simple situations. So even looking at the standard cost there, Kim, that's showing us $15 a month. You take that, you go into the basic tab, and then look at the cost there. It's $4.99 a month. That's a cup of coffee,
yeah.
I think, for a lot of people.
I mean, it's an expensive cup of coffee, but it's kind of like a
yeah.
cup. All right. So yeah, the idea of a DTU then is like pre-configured options, right? It's a simpler option, but the problem is it's less, like I said, there's less levers to pull. So it means that, you can't customize it quite as much if you have CPU versus sort of, disk-based differences essentially. Okay, but look, I think for today's session, we've talked about the different options. Probably for a lot of systems, you might go a vCore because that is the new recommended, but I think DTU is probably a good option for us at the moment to give us just a nice cheap database. So I'm going to go with this one. Is that all right? Basic?
Absolutely. Cool. Kim, we've got some questions in the chat window as well. Do you mind if we just take a look?
Yeah, well, actually, what I'll do before we do that, Glenn,
yep.
I'll just kick off this database creation.
Oh, good call. It'll take a little bit of time.
Because that'll take a few minutes. So let me go quickly here. Let's review and create. Okay. So what we can see is we've got our estimated cost per month. Beautiful. We're putting it into my pre-bake resource group. We can see some of this information. We'll talk about some of this networking stuff a little bit later on. There was options in there as well to change things like collation and things like that. We're just going to stick with the defaults. So I'm going to hit the create button. And that will start our deployment.
Awesome. So let's get over to the questions.
Let's do that.
Cool. Glenn's asked, not me, the other Glenn. Excellent. Hi, Glenn, from another one. If Van Arsdell was a heavy hitter, say 4 terabyte storage, 10,000 users, which Microsoft database might you advise? Yeah, so that's a different question. Again, like I think for that many users, you might look at a different database option to see what throughput you can get. I'd be looking at one of the higher tiers of SQL Server, or I'd probably try and calculate it based on existing usage and then see what servers I need and then compare that with other costs as well. Because at a larger scale, it might be that the database might need to change, or you might actually need to do some code changes to manage the scalability. So even things like putting caching into your web app, or using something like Redis cache or other options might actually help you achieve those numbers without actually having to do as much work or pay as much expense.
Cool.
And Gaurav has a question, can you change compute tier after the fact? Yes. And this Glenn has a question for you, Kim. It's bugging me how many floppy disks you need for the installation.
I looked this up the other day. It's a 21.
21.
1.44. That was the answer I got. I think it was 21 plus an initial setup disk, so 22, I think.
Cool. But having things unresolved is difficult for me, I must admit. Thanks.
All right. Cool. Now let's do a quick question as well, Glenn, just while we're waiting for our database. It won't take long, and we'll see if there's any other questions come in as well. Glenn says that was a good answer, Glenn.
Thanks.
I like you Glenns are agreeing with each other. Okay, let's do a quick question here. Knowledge check. Who's responsible for performing software updates on your Azure SQL databases and the underlying OS? So just answer in the chat window, is it A, well, you're responsible, you know, it's up to you to log in, install the latest security patches and updates. Is it Azure, because it manages the hardware and the software updates and the patches for you? Or is it no one, right? You basically create your database and it just stays with that version of the OS and the software configuration. So pop any answers you have into the chat window. And while you think about that, I'm gonna go and have a quick look and see how our database creation is going.
Cool, let's have a look. We've got just a couple of answers that have come through. Some nice answers coming through. Cool, yeah. How's that creation process coming along, Kim?
It's done, Glenn.
It is?
And you know, I've myself had some times in the past where I've had to like set up SQL service, you know, on premises. It wasn't that quick, I can tell you.
No. You couldn't even walk to the delivery van, pick it up and bring it back.
Absolutely. So the good news is looking at the answers, I think people are onto it, you know? So what we're talking about is, you know, with Azure SQL, it's a platform as a service essentially, or a database as a service. So, you know, you don't have to worry about updating versions of software and patches and all that sort of craziness. So that's really good news. Beautiful. All right, Glenn, so let's just flick back to the portal here and just check what has actually happened here. And if we see our deployment screen here, we can see that it has created a SQL DB. Did I call that SQL DB? I didn't mean to call that SQL DB. I meant to call it, that one was a SQL server. Okay.
Yeah.
If we go and have a look at that. So I've actually poorly named that one, I think. So there we can see our SQL database. And we can see the server name on there as well. Doesn't have elastic pools. But look, you know, we've got our database at the moment. What we want to talk about now is we want to talk about some data access tools, Glenn. Have you got any data access tools that you like to work with?
Yeah, I do. Kim, you know I develop on multiple operating systems as well. So one of the ones I like using is actually Data Studio, which is a really good tool to use. And if you want to do cross-platform types of development, it's really nice. It actually looks like Visual Studio Code when you run it. And it's actually effective as a tool. I think probably, Kim, we might run it. Do you have it on your machine?
Of course I do, Glenn. Of course I do. So let's have a look here. It's a little bit sort of small to look at, so I'm going to sort of zoom in here. But look, it's very much a Visual Studio Code kind of you know, interface, I suppose. And you know, this is just one tool. Some people like to use, you know, SQL Enterprise Manager, things like that. And you're fine to use all of those different options. Anything that works with SQL is going to work with your Azure SQL database. So look, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of zoom in here and I'm going to create myself a connection. So I've got a connection in my local database. Create myself a connection. And it's going to come up with some information down the bottom here. Sorry, it's actually got quite a small UI. So let me just zoom in here. So the very first thing we need is we need a server name, right? So this should be pretty familiar to people, familiar with SQL Server. And to get that server name, it's right here, right? So we're having a look at our SQL database. We can see our server name. So I can go ahead, copy that to the clipboard, duck back over to our portal. Our Data Studio. Put that in. What kind of login do I want? Now, of course, you can set up different authentication schemes. I've set up a SQL login for this one, and my username. That in. And let's have a look at what databases exist. Now, something interesting is happening here, Glenn. I've got myself a bit of an error. Let's have a look at that. It says my client IP doesn't have access to the server. Okay, what's that about, Glenn?
Yeah, well, what's happened is that your client IP address doesn't really have access, like it says. It's all about security. One of the requirements we talked about for VNASDAQ was security. So even though the server has a public IP address assigned to it, it doesn't allow external connections. Essentially, it has a white list of addresses that can connect into it. So in the portal, we need to actually set up that firewall settings for the database to let our Azure Data Tool make the connect in. The Azure Data Tool can make the changes on our behalf as well if we logged in with our Azure account, which I think you did, Kit.
Well, I could do it from here. I could add an account. I don't have it added into here, Glenn, but if I wanted to add an account, I could, and I could actually get Azure Data Studio to set this all up for me. But I remember discussing this with you the other day, and you made a valid point that whilst we could just do this, the thing is a lot of people use different tools that probably don't have this facility. So we should go to the portal and have a look at how we flick these levers.
Yeah, that's really true. There's a lot of people that use third-party SQL Server tools, and they'll still work. A lot of them will still work on Azure SQL Server as well. So it's really important to understand the portal process for managing the firewall for your database.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm looking at my database here, SQL database, and I've got this button up the top here, which says set server firewall. If I go ahead and click that, there's a few interesting options inside of here. So one of those interesting options is allow Azure services and resources to access this server, right? So we actually want to turn that on because we have our web application, which is going to connect through to this, right? If I don't turn that on, it's not going to be able to connect. So I want that. I want that to turn on. There's also, things about denying public network access as well. So it depends on how your network topology is, I suppose, inside of Azure. But for me to get over my particular issue, I need to add my IP into the firewall. And so it's got this handy little button here, add client IP. So now everyone knows my IP address. And I hit the save button. That's very important, hit the save button. Okay. And it sort of says, yes, that's successfully changed. Beautiful. And now if I go back to my Data Studio, I'll just cancel that for a second, and drop down my list of databases. All things going well. Oh, we don't have a database. Why do we not have a database?
Well, check the connection type. It's Microsoft SQL Server.
A SQL login.
Yeah. Is the user credentials right?
No, they're not, Glenn.
They're not?
No, because that's not the username. So that's a really bad
mistake. This is pair configuring.
but also, it was a pretty poor error message as well. So let's see if that works. This is the joys of live stuff, right?
Yeah, it is.
Hey, there's my database. Beautiful. Nice. All right, so we're going to select that one. Phew. All right, so now I can go ahead and I can connect to that. All right, and then what we should have is we've got a connection to our database in there. Okay, but whilst we have a connection to the database, we really don't have much going on inside of there, do we?
No, there's not really data.
So what we really want to do is we want to talk about migration now. So Glenn, what are our options for migrating our database?
Well, I think for migrating our data, we could either use the Azure Data Migration Service or we can use the Data Migration Assistant app. That's probably a good call. But the Data Migration Service, essentially it sits in the cloud and we can set up a virtual network to connect from the cloud onto an on-premise instance of our SQL Server so we can have the seamless communication between on-premises and the cloud. And that service is actually really great for large-scale database migrations across a virtual network.
Okay, so that's the data migration service, right? So this is what you want to use for large environments.
There's a bit of setup involved for that. And for smaller projects, you probably want to use something a little bit simpler. So for a single database, like the Data Migration Assistant would work just as well. In fact, it gets installed locally and then it pushes data up to the cloud.
Okay, so that's a much simpler option for us. I suppose there are some considerations here as well, right? I'm actually whether it's live data you're doing, you know, whether you can take that offline for a while in order to do it. The data migration service deals with all of that stuff in terms of if there's still records changing as it's migrating. Data migration assistant is a much simpler approach, but you know, for a lot of people, the simplicity of it, it makes it sound like a really good option as well. So for us today, Glenn, we're gonna go with that data migration assistant.
Good.
Okay.
Good.
Sound good?
Yeah. Ideal choice, I think, for us.
Ideal. All right. Well, let's go and have a look at it. Have we got any questions in the chat window before we do that? Ganesh was fixing our username. Thank you, Ganesh.
Ganesh, I'm going to click the like on that one. That was a solid call.
Solid. All right. Let me bring up the data migration assistant here. All right, and I might sort of zoom in here as well, because this has got a fairly small UI. So the idea of the data migration assistant it pretty much does exactly what the name implies. It migrates data. So it's project-based, so you can create projects and you can work on those. So in our case, we're gonna create a new project. We've got a couple of options here. We can say, okay, do we want to just do an assessment of our data and see whether it can data do it? Or we're going to be brave, we're just going to do a migration. Okay, so that means I'm going to migrate my data. So I give it a project name. Let's call this Van Aerstel. Let's just call it Van Aerstel Dev. And essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to give it a source and a destination. So my source is from a SQL server, local SQL server. Okay, and I'm going to go and put this into an Azure SQL database. Okay, but you can see here there are different options here. In fact, you can use this just to move data between two servers if you want. It's a pretty cool tool. But we're going to use an Azure SQL database and we want to migrate the schema and the data. But we could, if we like, just change the schema, just do the schema or the data. Okay, so I'm going to create this project. Okay, and what we're going to do is we're going to go across the top here. We're going to select a source, a destination, and then our various options. So our server name for our source, I'm going to zoom this in here because it's a little bit small, is going to be our local database. We're doing Windows authentication here. Of course, you've got your different options inside of here as well. I'm going to connect up to that. And what it's going to do is it's going to query that database. It's going to show me, or that server, show me all the databases. Now, there's some pretty wacky names that I have on my file system here, and that's just because Entity Framework rolls that way, but I happen to know it's this one. So I'm going to select that one. Hopefully yours are slightly better named. I'm going to connect up to that. Oh, sorry. I'm after this next button down the bottom corner here. Okay, and now what I'm after is my target database. Now it turns out I could actually create an Azure SQL database right here if I wanted to. Otherwise, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get my server name. I might even still have that in my clipboard. Inside of there. And my authentication, I've got SQL Server. In this case, username is Van Arsdale. And making sure Ganesh.
Yeah, I'm just checking with Ganesh as well, Kim. That's good.
And we'll get that right. Beautiful. And we'll try connect to that.
Awesome.
Okay, so now what it's doing is it's going to connect to the database, and it worked, and it said, hey, these are the databases you have there. I've got MySQL DB Van Arsdale Dev. Beautiful. Let's go next.
Well, while we're here, Kim.
Yeah.
We're going to select the objects, it looks like, of what we're going to migrate. Right. There's a question from Sudeep on the chat window. I think it's kind of relevant, which is, does the data migration assistant also take care of all the objects, like tables, functions, SQL stored procedures, and probably views as well, right? All those sorts of things. So let's have a look at the objects that we can move over. So maybe because we've only got tables in our database, that's what's coming up.
Yeah, it is. I believe it'll do other things as well, Glenn.
Yeah, that's my assumption also.
Yeah.
So there's stored procedures and things like the schema structure and the data within it.
Yeah. Can be the really cool thing about this is what it really does at the end of the day, when I say generate SQL script, it scripts it out for you, all the various objects. So you'll see here, it'll just take a moment. And then what it's done is it's created me, you know, big bunch of scripting here, which I could save for later on or copy it, or I can just go ahead and I can execute it as well. And so, you know, if you have a look at what it does, it's pretty much standard Transact SQL sort of stuff. It's just creating the table, but you can get it to run it. So I can say deploy the schema, and it will basically just go run through that and execute it against my target database.
Cool. We're seeing the migration happen in real time, well, at least with the schema.
That's the schema, yeah. But down the bottom here on the right, I've got this little button that says migrate data. Okay, and press that button. It's going to do just like the name implies. It's going to basically say, okay, here's a bunch of tables that I found. Which data out of these would you want to migrate? Okay, we're just going to go with all of them for the moment. But you know, you can select and deselect different ones if you like as well. So I'm going to start that data migration, and it's really just going to sort of zoom through those tables and update them. Or move the data.
Yeah, I know from my projects, Kim, I 10 tables seems like a really small amount. So it's for larger projects, it just takes a little bit longer.
Pretty much.
There's also a question from Anonymous. How does live production data migration to cloud happen without any or minimal downtimes, I imagine? So that would be where we use the other database option, really, for migration. That's you'd use the Azure Data Migration Service, so you could maintain that connectivity and flow between your on-premises database and your cloud-based database while it's happening. If it's more complex than that, you may need to look at other options, but that's the general ballpark response.
Yeah, and that will actually have, you know, you install essentially a proxy, right? Or I can't think of the right word at the moment, but a little bit of software that's actually going to sit there talking to your database and pushing that data and looking for any changes that are happening at the same time.
Yeah, I think in that situation, there's probably not a one size fits all look at your requirements and what you're doing, because your applications might have databases, they might have other systems in place like queuing mechanisms, and you never know what the total holistic view of your application is, and you need to consider that when you're migrating.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Glenn, it looks like we're done. It took a total of 23 seconds. I mean, I just had a pretty small amount of tables there. So now that we've done our migration, I think what we can do is we can probably flick over to our Data Studio here and try querying it, right? So probably if we do a refresh of this, so this is my SQL database. So out we can see it's actually migrated those tables, and if I was to write a pretty rubbish query here, like select star from properties is the table that holds the properties, and do an execute here, we can see it's got our fantastic test data inside of there. Okay, but it's actually querying that live database. So we've, you know, we have successfully gone and migrated that that data across. So definitely a moment for us.
That's cool. But I think that confetti is useful at this point in time, but we're almost done here, not quite done. So when we started the session, we said we've got the website up in the cloud, but it's not connected to the database yet, is it?
So it's not.
Maybe we can open up here again. So if we open the website, remember it's got that message that comes across, says, are you missing a database connection string? Because right now we don't have the database configured in the web application. So we have to think about how we do that. And if those of you on the line are familiar with ASP.NET, you probably already know the answer to this one. So.
I've got an idea, Glenn.
Yes, Kim.
So if I open my visual, here's one option, and you can tell me whether this is a bad option or not, okay? so one thing I could do inside of my project here is I could like go and get my app settings JSON file, right? And I could just jam my connection string in there and then republish my application. Would that be a good option?
Yeah, I don't think it would be, because you've got that all in your source code. You're going to check it into GitHub. I know you and I personally have been on projects where we accidentally set a GitHub repository to public when it shouldn't have been, and that can create all sorts of dilemmas. So there's some better options for us there. Do you want to take us through, Kim?
Yeah, so what we can do inside of here, you know, if we wanted to say connect to if we wanted to test connecting to our SQL, Azure SQL database, we can actually come in here and somewhere there's a manage user secrets, right? And we could actually put the connection string in here. And that would be great for us for our local testing to connect up to that database if we need to do that. But there's a really good option inside of Azure. We can actually go and override those configuration values ourselves. So what we can do is back in the portal, and I might just zoom this in so people can see it, is I can put those settings in my app service. So what I need is I need a connection string, right? So what I can do is I can say, I'm currently looking at my SQL database, and I can click on show database connection strings, and this is gonna show me these connection strings that we have here. It's not gonna have my password in there, that's a good thing, right? But it does have my username, and you know, it's just a connection string, right? So I can grab that connection string. And then what I wanna do is come back over to my resources. So if I have a look at my app service, okay, which is this one here, there's actually this configuration section down the bottom here. Okay, and if I click on that configuration section, there's a connection strings area. So what I can do is I can come in here and I can add that in. So it's called the setting is called default configuration, default connection. And then I can go ahead and I can paste in my value in here. And probably want to update my password. This is going to be really embarrassing, Glenn.
Why is that?
Because you're going to see me type it.
I thought it was just a series of dots.
It is. All right, look away. Okay, and so now we say, hey, what are we connecting to? We're connecting to SQL Azure, aren't we?
Yeah.
Okay, and this information, is this going to be secure where I put this, Glenn?
Well, it'll be stored within Azure in our configuration. So it's got a good level of security around it. Certainly better than checking it into our version control.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our code base.
All right. And the most important thing, and the thing I always forget to do, Glenn, is hit this little button up the top here that says save.
Yeah.
That's absolutely. Add that connection in. We're going to say save.
Cool. Well, yeah, I've made that mistake plenty of times, Kim.
Yeah.
If you don't understand where your configuration is, make sure you've actually saved it.
Yeah. And it basically says, okay, if I'm changing this connection string, it's going to restart my application. So I say, yeah, that's okay. We can deal with that. This will take just a second.
There's some questions while it's doing that as well, Kim. Does Azure have good migration tools for migrating Oracle databases to the Azure family? If you look at the create a resource within the Azure portal, you'll actually find that Oracle is an option within the database list. So you can use normal Oracle migration tools to move data from your on-premises environment to the cloud. Oracle has a huge range of configuration settings. So you again, like most things, you choose a path that's appropriate to your migration. And there's another question, how does database migration take care of any constraints, like foreign key constraints? It does. It falls into the same category as the stored procedures and views and triggers. And is using Key Vault the quickest approach without any deployments and restarts? That's a good question. Kim, do you want to answer that one?
That would definitely be an option. So Key Vault is about keeping your setting secure. I would have thought deployment slots is probably where you want to be, right? So deployment slots is that whole idea of, you know, you can take one offline, you can update it, and then bring it back and swap it across.
Key Vault's certainly not quick. There's normally code changes and other configurations you might need to make in order to make it work, though. Yeah, it's probably worth looking at the Key Vault for your project and configuration.
Yeah. So I don't know off the top of my head. Yeah.
It's certainly not secure, though.
Absolutely. Okay, so at our app services has restarted, right? So hopefully if I come over here now and I refresh this, then what I should see, you can see it's spinning up here a little bit because it's a fresh start.
Cool.
Oh, nice. So we have some properties, right? Yeah. So what we've done is we've basically just got our website and we've pointed that puppy through a connection string to our Azure SQL database where we migrated the data to. So so that's a win, right?
That is definitely confetti worthy, that one. That's cool, Kim.
Fantastic. All right, so I think we've, you know, mission accomplished there. So Glenn, do you want to give us a bit of a summary of what we've done today? A bit of a wrap up.
Yeah, of course. So we wanted to migrate a locally hosted SQL Server database into the Azure Cloud. And we had specific goals in mind. We wanted the same code base. We wanted low maintenance. We wanted scalability, security, and to use the technology we already know just to limit that learning curve. So we decided an Azure SQL Server database was the best choice. It's very similar to working with a local SQL Server installation. That meets our goals of using a technology we already know and understand. We then talked about the vCore-based provisioning configuration as the best option for Van Arsdale. We also introduced the DTU option there as well. But the vCore option allowed us to match the hardware specs on our local server. And just by dragging a slider, we could adjust the hardware specification that was needed. And we could do that without any downtime. And that helped us meet our low maintenance requirements, as well as the requirement of scalability. Now for today's exercise though, we just used the DTU option just to keep the costs even lower. Now once the database was created, we analyzed two different options for migrating our schema, and we chose the data migration system, which we ran through. We connected the database, we moved it from the on-premises database up into the cloud, not only the schema, but also the data, which is a really great approach. And the best part about this, Kim, which I think is confetti worthy as well, nearly, is that we didn't have to change our code base at all. And we only had to update the configuration settings. And that was the last of our goals. And without a managed database service of Azure, then we'd have to maintain a SQL Server installation and the underlying operating system, which would mean more maintenance and patching and all those sorts of things. So we've certainly put Van Arsdale in a good position. And yep. Azure SQL Database frees us from the maintenance and allows us to focus on the customer experience, which is really what's going to enable us to optimize our costs and provide a better experience for everyone using the service.
Yeah, so that's, you know, it's so much better than having to manage that stuff yourself. Beautiful. So really great option. Now let's just quickly let me just quickly show a couple of resources as well that you might want to have a look at. A couple of Learn modules. So if you haven't gone to Learn, hopefully you will go to Learn. There is a great option on provisioning an Azure SQL database to store application data, securing your Azure SQL database, developing and configuring ASP.NET applications that query an Azure SQL database. So there are a few of the modules that I just quickly went and had a look at and said, yeah, these would be good additional information from what we've covered today. So definitely go and check those out. Now, remember, you know, this is not our last session, right? We've actually taken our database, we've taken our web application, we're actually in the cloud now, right? So everything's up in the cloud. So that's a really good thing. In our next session, though, what we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about deployment, right, and fixing that deployment story, because you've got all this stuff, you know, managed up in the cloud, but you don't want your developers, you know, always, you know, pushing releases and making that hard. So we're going to talk about a way of doing sort of continuous deployment from GitHub as well, and make our developers happy. And when your developers are happy, everyone's happy. Well, I say that because I'm a developer. So before we sign off, Glenn, have we got any other questions that we want to cover off?
I think we had a few come through. Anonymous had a comment, quote, connection strings for key vaults. I'm assuming you want to know a little bit more about key vaults. There is some Learn modules on key vaults, which will show you how to use that. Certainly the key vault documentation is amazingly good for that. So I would check that out. Also, can we migrate 1 terabyte database from an on-premises to cloud? Can we use the data migration tool or any other tool? If it's just a lift and move without interrupting core operations, you could probably use the data assistant. It would take a long time. There's other options available for migration. I think there's some existing documentation around migrations in general that are probably worth looking at. The patterns and practices team, Kim, do they have an area for migration?
Look, I'm pretty sure they would actually.
Yeah. I would check that out. Hopefully we can, Ron can have a look at that before we close the session off.
Yeah, I'm gonna just do a quick Google while you.
Do we have a log-based migration tool for zero downtime migration? I'm not sure on that one. If we did, like, again, I mean, you probably have to look at the migration paths for that. Look at your core requirements. I mean, some database systems will have change logs that update. I've certainly worked on systems like that in the past. That it's not a one size fits all. I would. That's probably a conversation rather than a question.
Yeah. So a quick bit of Googling led me to this page here, Glenn. And of course, this is part of the Cloud Adoption Framework, right? Which is amazing resource. So people should, you know, don't just sort of start migrating your Azures to your Azures before you work out what you're doing. It's a process, but it does have a whole section on Azure database migration, right? And some tutorials on here, how to do it, you know, offline, how to do it online with the various types of databases as well. I think I'll drop that in the chat window because it's probably a good one to have a look at. And you know, think about what your data is, what your size is, what your requirements are in terms of whether you can take things offline for a while, or whether it's going to be live. You know, a lot of considerations in there. So, but you know, the cloud adoption framework is amazing. Definitely check that out.
Cool. So Anonymous says, was there a size difference in the database between the way it was stored on local versus Azure? So we actually set the size of what we had. I don't believe there would be. There's comparable storage between the two. Can we share some information on how to perform, tune, and capture long running queries, etc.? Yeah, that's probably better at the database level. I'll go over and look at the SQL Server option and look at the documentation about the profiling tools there. That's probably a longer investigation, but certainly you could. Matt Calder posted the link for the next session in the series, so hopefully you all sign up for that, and we'll see you on some other ones. And the last comment, or the last question, there's a few comments and thanks, so we appreciate those. I see the maximum database size for Gen 5 is 4 terabyte. What is the process and the requirement changes, and we need more than 4 terabytes database size? I think if you go beyond that limit, you probably need to change infrastructure or look at how you're splitting your databases and act accordingly. I've certainly reached limits in the past, but then you tend to have to think in terms of re-architecture based on the new requirements.
Yep, no worries. Fantastic. All right. Well, I think that's all of our questions. But look, we're going to be back for another session where, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about the deployment story next, and then we'll get all our developers happy. And then in the following session, we're going to write some code, which is going to be fun because I love developing. But I think for now, we're at time. So thanks everyone for joining us. Thanks for the questions. Love the questions. Go and have a look at aka.ms/learn for some additional learn modules. We love your feedback and suggestions. So I think Matt Calder posted a link out to the survey as well. So please send that through. So from me, it's goodbye, Glenn.
Goodbye also. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. Hopefully you join us back next time. And bye for now.